Welcome to Regulatory Ramblings. As banking and financial institutions and multinational corporations around the world begin to fully utilize technological capabilities as a proactive approach to detecting and thwarting financial crime, the global regulatory landscape has become more complex, costly, and cumbersome for those entities working across borders. Navigating the anti-money laundering landscape in the Asia-Pacific region, for example, presents formidable challenges as organizations must be well-prepared to address the myriad requirements in jurisdictions with vastly different levels of development and financial and legal sophistication. Financial crime in the region also exhibits a high degree of complexity and is increasingly intertwined with digital channels. In fact, several APAC countries led by authoritarian governments have often prioritized economic recovery over anti-bribery and anti-corruption efforts, thus leading to a pressing need for comprehensive and up-to-date regulatory guidance to ensure that financial institutions, for example, are operating in this region, adhere to global AML standards. And that's something that the region's governments haven't always offered. To that end, AI-powered solutions for financial crime and third-party risk management using the best-in-class data, cutting-edge machine learning, and AI technologies to optimize AML sanctions and anti-corruption compliance are key. The ultimate aim is to bring about greater transparency to risk management workflows, enabling financial institutions and corporates to screen customers and third parties at speed and scale. Our guest today is hopefully going to be able to shed some light on this. Michael Heller is Vice President and Head of the Financial Crime Proposition at Dow Jones. Having been with Dow Jones for a decade, he's currently responsible for corporate strategy, including global development. A lawyer by training, as well as having been a sales executive and a consultant, his mission is to ensure clients build efficient compliance and risk management programs that leverage the right data and technology. Michael's career has been focused on bringing transparency to global business. After law school, he worked as a consultant at the Business Intelligence Group, and later the AML Group at Goldman Sachs in New York. Michael's also served as the Chief Compliance Officer and Counsel at Abacus Wealth Partners in Los Angeles. He's currently a member of the State Bar of California. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, AJ.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, as a lawyer who segued into the world of financial crime and now increasingly the technical component to what you do, just, you know, sketch out that journey for us so that we can understand your career path.
Absolutely. So when I was in law school,
and where did you grow up? Where are you from originally?
Actually, from California as well.
Okay, cool.
So in law school, I really I saw a lot of the investment moving into the BRIC countries. And that really kind of motivated me to ask just a very simple question, which is, how do multinationals, how do investors operate in jurisdictions where rule of law is developing? And so as a result of that question, I sort of stumbled into, not only some of the positive components of globalization, right, like economic development, interconnectivity, et cetera, but also some of the challenges with respect to globalization around anti-money laundering and the proliferation of money laundering, as well as anti-corruption.
First, a background question before we dive into what, the utility of AI and people availing themselves of that. With the increasing prevalence of money laundering cases in our region, we were wondering if you could elaborate on the importance of enabling financial institutions and corporations to conduct efficient due diligence and scale up their adverse media screening processes. What are your, I'm guessing you're based in LA?
Based in Los Angeles, correct.
Okay. So you must have a particular view then. I mean, you're close to the Pacific, close to the scene situation in Asia than people in the rest of the U.S. But I mean, from your vantage point in L.A., what do you see is the importance of giving institutions the ability to conduct efficient due diligence, or increasingly what I'm hearing, enhanced due diligence, whatever that means, to you know, to scale up their adverse media screening processes, because the fact of the matter is a lot of what they need a lot of the time is in the public domain. It's just about being able to search for it.
That's right. You know, in light of sort of the meteoric growth of countries in the Asia Pacific region, you see sort of generation skipping technology. So actually, financial institutions, fintechs, multinationals in the region don't have to deal with a lot of the legacy systems that you know, we see at some companies, you know, in the US and Europe. And as a result, there's an opportunity to really be at the, you know, cutting edge of tech. And, you know, it's interesting from sort of my own experience in this industry over the last 15 plus years, you know, you've really seen a lot of the stakeholders, which have been traditionally attorneys, folks with regulatory backgrounds, accountants, investigators. And over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, you've seen project managers, technologists, data scientists. And so, you know, given kind of where APAC is from a technology standpoint and from a growth standpoint, you certainly see an opportunity to adopt. And as I mentioned before, with generation skipping technology, implement cutting edge tech and data to make more efficient and effective their anti-money laundering and their anti-corruption programs to detect and identify those types of risks.
There's definitely something to be said for being a later adopter of technologies, and that you can see from others what works, what doesn't, learn from their mistakes, see and adapt what's relevant to your situation. And I think Hong Kong sometimes sits on the sidelines for too long, but they want to be absolutely sure that it particular solution or particular rule is applicable to them, or that it doesn't clash with local business considerations on the ground. So if we dive into the meat of it, then how is AI poised to emerge as the solution for organizations and their efforts to combat financial crime? Because, you know, we had someone on our show a little while back that said that increasingly when vendors are showing up at you know, prospective clients' doorsteps and, you know, offering their array of software and solutions, and AI increasingly comes up either because it's a genuine part of what they're offering, or, you know, it's a buzzword, it's the dish du jour, people expect to be, you know, pitch something along the lines of AI. What we heard recently from Abhishek Bali at Zigram was that companies are kind of skittish about AI. They don't want to deal with it because the view is, okay, every door, every portal swings both ways. How much of my company's private proprietary data is this AI platform soaking in, and could that pose a threat for me later on? So, with that in mind, to what extent is AI the solution in financial crime compliance?
Yeah, so oftentimes, if you're looking at financial crime compliance in 2023, right? Yeah. I often like to use a quote by Tour de France winner Greg LeMond. You know, it never gets easier. You just go faster, right?
Yeah.
Sure. And so even if you have a better bike, right, if you train, you know, you're able to cover more ground, but, you know, the process, the stress, the challenges for analysts around the world fighting financial crime might not necessarily get easier, but they can become more effective and certainly efficient. And just like in cycling, you know, if you don't adopt the latest technology, right, you could get left behind by the peloton. And the ability to catch up is extremely difficult once you get dropped. I've actually been in that position. And so while there's this pressure to adopt cutting edge technology, which, by the way, shapes regulatory expectations, it shapes, you know, industry standards. Of course, we've heard FATF, we've heard MAS, we've heard Wolfsburg talk about these issues. So there's, on the one hand, there's a tension, which is making sure you're on top of innovation, you're innovating your program. The other, of course, is, as you mentioned, some of the challenges and pitfalls around artificial intelligence, right? Explainability, auditability, being able to test the model, being able to explain to regulators why you missed something or why you received a hit is critical. And that's why, you know, here at Dow Jones, when we think about AI, we actually like to think about compliance-ready AI. And there are two different sort of tracks in order to do that, right? Starting with, you know, high-quality licensed content, right? So like any information system, you know, quality input in, right, can often lead to quality input out. And we know that the old adage, the opposite of that is garbage in, garbage out. So that's certainly important. And then, of course, partnering with a trusted technology company like Ripjar that, you know, is able to build a platform with our input, with industry input, with their own expertise that can, with advanced screening and monitoring, you know, provide machine learning in a in an explainable, compliance-ready way. So you sort of have both views, you know, critical to building both the correct data or providing the right content and providing the right technology.
Yeah, I mean, not having the best, the state-of-the-art technology that all your peers are using, relative to your size and your means, is going to be an awkward conversation with a regulator. By the same token, having the latest technology doesn't mean something won't slip through the cracks. And then, you know, there we have to account for human error. The other thing that I heard you mention was the quality of data. And it strikes me then that when we look at a lot of companies, I mean, you know, I used to be with Thomson Reuters. I was on the financial crime beat for close to 7 years. It seemed, I mean, when you look at all the companies that were in that space, Thomson Reuters, Dow Jones, Bloomberg, I mean, the differentiate, I mean, former presidential candidate Andrew Yang said this, that the oil of the 21st century is data, that the differentiating factor between a lot of companies is the quality of their data, the depth and the breadth of their databases. And yeah, I mean, what are your thoughts on that? That data matters just as much, or maybe more, than the technical means used by which to analyze it? Or am I overstating the case?
Well, you know, you think of data as the foundation, right? So at Dow Jones, everything we do, we believe in bringing transparency to global business by providing complete, accurate, and up-to-date information. That's been our mantra since the late 1800s, right? Now, the technology is critical and important, but once it hits mass adoption and mass, hits a critical mass in terms of functionality, right? The differentiator can certainly be the content of the data. Take, for instance, Netflix. When you stream Netflix, you think about what you're going to watch. You think about the content, not the technology. Now, if the streaming technology was where it was 10, 15 years ago, you would also think about the streaming technology. But we've hit a certain point with respect to, you know, bandwidth over the internet and delivery of information that now really the focus is the content. And that's why it's so important for us to continue to build actionable content that is consistent with our principles as a publisher.
Right, because I mean, it is not the case that Amazon has any advantage technologically over Netflix, and at least not at a discernible level.
Yeah, I mean, that's a different business model, right? Than Dow Jones, right? And it's Amazon does a lot of different, has a lot of different businesses, right? Including its server business, e-commerce business, its streaming business. But, you know, I think that there's a recognition if you're just talking about, you know, Netflix versus Amazon and the streaming industry, right? Content and content rights is critical. And that's why a lot of these firms, including Netflix, a little over a decade ago, began building its own content, right? Because there's this recognition that once technology, you know, hits this level, differentiator isn't going to be, like, I think what you're getting at, streaming service to streaming service, is going to be, you know, what goes in those pipes. And that's why, you know, at Dow Jones, we've really focused and doubled down on that. Even when, you know, I think that there was some, you know, assumptions in the industry that you could just get content anywhere, right? And you can, like, but it comes at a cost, right? If you do get certain open source, unlicensed content, the reliability, the structuring, the false positive, I think you mentioned earlier about, you know, finding the right information. And, you know, 20 years ago, it was difficult to find any information from your desktop, you know, instantly, or 25 years ago. But now it's about finding the right information quickly, right? And that's really where we're focused on helping our customers.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem to me that, I mean, if we just look at three major competitors, well, if you look at Wall Street Journal, Factiva, Dow Jones, Bloomberg, Thomson Reuters, I mean, it does seem to me that it comes to a certain point where people see what works for their competitors. They try to copy it. They try to adopt some of the same practices and technology. Over time, it seems as though the differences between these, you know, these groups is competing parties is being, it's being leavened. I'm not saying that some don't still have somewhat of a decisive edge, but, you know, I mean, and then we come back to the streaming model, you know, of content producers. And, you know, I guess you could take this, one could even take the Sony approach, which is they don't have their own streaming service, but in a market that's turning into an arms race, the only way to profit is to be the arms dealer. And that is to say, providing, you know, providing the content, providing the data.
Well, it's funny. So this is an honest answer. I actually really don't pay a lot of attention to what our competitors do in the space.
Interesting.
Because that does require a significant amount of energy that I think instead is better focused on building easy to use, helpful products that enable our customers to identify and evaluate third-party risk consistent with regulatory expectations. And even as when I was a specialty sales executive for risk and compliance, that's really what I focus on when I was trying to basically help clients deploy our solutions in the most efficient and effective way is, you know, what do we have that can address the requirements? I've been on the other side of the table of our customers, right? And absolutely understand the challenges. You know, you only really get recognition when you miss something, right?
Of course.
You know, and that's why it's a very stressful, challenging job. So any way we can enable our customers to keep up with regulatory expectations, technological innovation in data, in, you know, in both big data, structured data, and licensed content, you know, really kind of is a key component for kind of why I, you know, go to the office every day.
If we take a step back, what are the key trends you see in the Asia Pacific at large when it comes to the development of disruptive technologies and the associated risks they pose to financial institutions?
Absolutely. You know, you talked about obviously Hong Kong, which you know is aspiring to be a leader in crypto, right? And VASP.
That's what they say.
Yeah,
that's what they're.
And so you know, and then obviously at the same time, there's out of HKMA's, you know, expressed a commitment to preventing financial crime and having strict money laundering rules. And so, you know, I think that those are both trends that we see globally and specifically in the Asia Pacific region, where the mass adoption of crypto as a means, not as an investable asset, which, you know, I think we've all kind of seen some of the challenges with crypto as an investable asset, but as a way to quickly move stored value, you know, between different parties without a typical financial institution intermediary, right? And so, you know, while the technology, again, is certainly enabling efficiencies, right? It also has significant risks with respect to money laundering. And so, you know, some of the trends that we're seeing are, you know, sanctions targeting illicit actors in the crypto space, right? You know, even to the extent the extraterritorial nature of U.S. OFAC sanctions on key virtual asset service providers that, you know, while of course there are certainly legitimate uses of crypto for moving stored value in you know, in an efficient way, there certainly is with blockchain technology the ability to detect trends with respect to virtual asset service providers that kind of focus on the illicit side, you know, supporting criminal activities, supporting sanctions, circumvention, et cetera. So that's been a big trend. And, you know, if you go from sort of the on-chain world of crypto and then you move into traditional financial institutions in the Asia Pacific region, you know, we think that it's been important for financial institutions to be able to quickly identify if they're doing business with an entity or even an algorithm, which I won't digress there, but that conducts VASP related services, because for money laundering and financial crime compliance, identifying that high risk party, whether or not they, you know, you want to continue to do business with VASP, whether you want to conduct more investigative due diligence, or you want to terminate the relationship. The first step for traditional financial institutions is to identify their exposure. And if they're providing commercial lending, commercial banking, if some of their customers are transferring fiat, we're seeing a huge requirement, a tremendous requirement for detecting at least any exposure to VASP. And then it's up to the financial institution to decide how they're going to treat, terminate, tolerate that type of, or transfer the risk for that type of relationship.
And that's if they're you know, being systematic about it and adopting some semblance of a risk-based approach to compliance. What we frequently see in the past, say, half decade is, if not more, is just wholesale de-risking, debanking, you know, getting rid of clients in particular categories. You know, those in fisheries, those dealing in the jewelry business, gemstones, you know, concerns over blood diamonds, what have you, in some cases, clients in shipping, because they're perceived to be high risk, you know, certain forms of entertainment, there seem to be high risk and or unsavory, and consequently, the banks don't want to have anything to do with them. And, yeah, I mean, There is a difference between just wholesale de-risking versus what you're saying, which is to be more systematic about it, which comes to my next point about our de facto central bank and banking regulator, the HKMA, has taken a number of initiatives to encourage the industry's adoption and to support its vision for AML-CFT RegTech in the city. And one of them is natural language processing for news monitoring. How do you see this technology making a difference for banks? And is it that different from what they already do?
Yeah, I think so. I think the point you made about de-risking, right? So, yeah. You know, part of being a compliance officer or FinCrime compliance professional is identifying the risks, of course, but it's also the ability to identify, you know, false matches or risks that seem like they're connected, but in fact are not, because right, not providing, you know, banking services to somebody who or an entity that, you know, falls into a particular category, you know, is certainly problematic and a challenge, right? Without getting more detail, so right. You know, I think what NLP for negative news does, and you know, this might be part of the HKMA. Framework allows you to be a little bit more nuanced in your review and to be more nuanced at scale. And so if you're able to, as I mentioned, we have structured data, which we've been building for over 20 years. And that does cover some negative news, right? But in addition to that, we're finding, based on regulatory guidance, based on our customers and where the technology is, we're seeing the requirement to add additional tiers to the risk-based approach to identify those nuances. So you're only, de-risking the customers that need to be de-risked. And one way to do that is through natural language processing, right? The ability to take large amounts of information, right, and find the sentence or the with and add the context in a scalable manner, leveraging artificial intelligence to surface risk relevant information, in a scalable way that you could do not just through one off investigations, but through ongoing screening and monitoring. So what NLP and machine learning and AI deployed in a compliance ready way can certainly strengthen your program so that you're doing business with the right folks and the people you want to do business, and you're not unnecessarily de-risking at the same time.
Certainly it needs to be done in a surgical manner. I think if some bankers have told me off the record that they don't like the sledgehammer approach they've taken to getting rid of, in many cases, long-term clients. But with the pressures of regulators breathing down their necks, they weren't quite sure what else to do to offload, again, what they perceived as high-risk customers, and everyone falls into a particular place in any given institution's risk matrix. They weren't quite sure what to do to offload these high-risk customers, what they perceived as high-risk customers, quickly, so as to be on what they felt was solid footing with the regulators. And again, it was counterproductive, because you're never going to get these clients back. Yeah, I mean, given the ill will that's going to linger, given the competition amongst institutions, you're never going to get those clients back. Good chance they'll go someplace else. If not, they're going to go into the shadow banking system, which poses its own risks, and consequently, the regulatory policy ends up shooting itself in the foot and end up having counterproductive results. I mean, that is a subtext to a lot of what we're talking about. Not just the technological aspect, not just the modalities of crime on at street level, but how regulatory policy needs to be tweaked to effectuate the right outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to sort of define the goal of regulatory policy, right? Because, part of what I've learned over the years is that, illicit activity in the traditional financial system is a destabilizing force, right? And so, while we certainly do not want to unnecessarily, prevent the right, illicit actors or, the majority of the population who are just looking for legitimate banking services, while you absolutely don't want to prevent that category of the majority of people access to the financial system, the tools and the capabilities in the past made it really difficult to efficiently and effectively manage that gray area. I do think the quality content coupled with compliance-ready AI, which is what we're focused on at Dow Jones, really does enable a more precise review to make right. sure that you're keeping the people you don't want to be part of your financial institution out, right? And you're doing business with the folks that, your board of directors, your governance committee certainly would, obviously with the goal of, being a profitable, successful business. And so, really the role of financial crime professional oftentimes is helping the bank, you know, harness the upside of these relationships and manage the downside risk. And so we're giving financial crime professionals better tools to do that. And so, of course, if you look at regulatory policy and you know, there's always a risk of shadow moving into shadow banking or offshore or different jurisdictions with weaker controls or to crypto, et cetera. You know, then if that's, you know, if the goal of your regulatory policy is to prevent illicit funds coming into the, you know, traditional banking system because it can actually destabilize the system, then, you know, that's something that happens and that's, you know, but your policy is still consistent. If your goal is to, you know, prevent all illicit activity, right? Number one, I think it's impossible, right? From getting into a financial system or illicit financial activity, that's likely impossible. And so, you know, I think the best really you could do is to prevent the legitimizing of illicit activity through a financial institution and doing it in, you know, and making it easier for that process to happen.
I suppose to the extent that fintech, regtech, to the extent that they can enable compliance departments to be able to deal with those difficult fine line borderline cases, because a lot of this is shades of gray. It's not a slam dunk. Mm-hmm. Again, where you fall into a risk matrix, it's highly subjective. It isn't as black and white as the rules imposed on institutions would have us believe. And then institutions then, in response to those rules and guidelines, seem to almost take a binary approach. Yes, we'll retain them. No, we won't. And if we won't, then that's a pretty binary proposition. That's when you get wholesale de-risking of entire categories of clients. And to the extent that the reg tech can help them discern, you know, through the smoke, who's a genuine risk and who isn't, you know, because as you said, you want to keep bad actors out, but you have a lot of good actors, legitimate businesses. They just happen to be in a high risk category. You know, through no fault of their own, that's just the business they've been in, and they've been deemed to be a high risk category. And again, it comes down to ferreting out the good ones and bad ones.
Yeah, so you know, I think risk management is a, you know, critical component to running a company or financial institution today, right? Yeah. And in fact, I think especially the fintechs, the virtual asset service providers, and of course the traditional financial institutions that, you know, integrate a holistic approach to risk management from obviously cyber all the way to financial crime, in the long term are able to build a successful business that can obviously harness some of the upsides in the growing economy, especially in the Asia Pacific region, and manage some of the downside risks. And so it's interesting, you're actually seeing some reg tech products come out of fintechs because the ability to manage that risk is so core to their business. And then, you know, you're also seeing, you know, as you mentioned, at a minimum, your content provider, your technology provider for KYC, anti-money laundering, sanctions compliance should help you. And this is in 2023, very quickly, make a decision around the black and white issues, right? The easy stuff: is somebody on OFAC or the MAS list, etc., right? And at scale,
you know, or something like World Check. And that's what I've noticed, that sometimes you have to acknowledge that maybe your competitor does have better data, and maybe a company should focus more on its strength, the technological processes, and maybe reach some kind of licensing agreement. with the providers of that better data. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I work at Dow Jones because I believe we have the best content, right, to help customers efficiently and effectively manage their risk. As I mentioned before, I'm not as concerned about other competitors because I think, you know, you look at Apple, right? Like, they are focused on building the best product for the consumer. We're focused, you know, on building the best product for, you know, for our compliance professional customers. And, you know, if we were looking at and focusing on sort of what was already in the market, then, you know, we wouldn't be focusing on the customer, which is number one for us, right?
Let's turn the spotlight then on Dow Jones. You have your own tool, the Advanced Screening and Monitoring System, ASAM. How do tools like ASAM address specific gaps in today's landscape? Because, you know, compliance has its issues. How does ASAM help the process?
So ASAM is built for high volume name screening, right? To help customers identify and evaluate legal, regulatory, reputational issues related to financial crime in their with respect to their relationships. So, you know, if you look at sort of the KYC AML workflow, right, you do the onboarding process, you do the data checks, et cetera. We're able to do that as well to screen against structured and unstructured data in a very efficient way. And then there's the ongoing screening and monitoring. So what we've done is taken our legacy of providing consolidated profiles on the structured side, right? We have government officials, relatives and close associates of government officials, over 160 sanctions lists, 250 other official lists globally. Our customers are everywhere in the world. And we have offices all over the world as well. You know, and then we went a step further to identify state-owned or controlled companies. This was all structured content that we built that went into typical rules-based, you know, search engines, right? And then what we were able to do in addition to the sort of traditional lists is that we mined our Factiva database, which we believe is one of the most powerful global media search engines in the world. And this was pre, you know, AI, right? And so we built structured data around individuals who've been formally accused, arrested, or convicted of crimes related to trafficking, terrorism, tax crime, you know, corruption, et cetera. And then we've also done similar categories with respect to entities. A lot of the crimes that we have in our definition are based on regulatory feedback, so predicate crimes. All of the content in our structured data is based on a clear definition, right? Is built with a standard consistent with the way we publish information in the Wall Street Journal, and we'll stand behind it the same way. And so, you know, that continues to be a critical foundation for us. So with advanced screening and monitoring, we enable our customers to screen names at scale, leveraging machine learning now to query those data sets and surface risk relevant information in a very effective, efficient way, because you're providing structured information, right? That's extremely been, you know, clean and has evolved over 20 years, combined with, you know, cutting edge machine learning technology that's been trained to surface and conduct and do entity resolution. So you know that the, you know, the results that you hit, there's a high likelihood that they're the same, surfacing information about the same subject that you're looking at within your financial institution. We've now been able to go one step further, given Ripchar's technology and advanced screening and monitoring, and go outside the four corners of our structured content and even the four corners of our very strict definitions around risk-relevant news to build risk-relevant news groupings out of our Factiva content, leveraging machine learning, right? You know, understanding the context, the difference between if you're talking about the Amazon rainforest and Amazon, the company, right? And so that enables our customers, as we talked about, to be more precise, to add an additional tier of screening and their risk-based approach. And you know, most importantly, to do it in a manner that was not available 5 years ago, right? That won't stop, you know, and slow down their compliance processes. As we know, efficiency is extremely important today.
Well, I mean, for one thing, the reason a lot of those models broke down 5 years ago was they just couldn't compute because it was the volume of information, right? It was aiming a fire hose at a teacup. I mean, the beauty of the programs now is, the algorithms now is, maybe it's not the same as human judgment, but they are coming a lot closer to our sense of discernment.
Yeah, they're very good at empowering the analyst to cover a lot more ground, right? And get, you know, and making less timely the, you know, the decisions around kind of, well, this is a relevant article, this is not, right? Those are more kind of black and white decisions. And as they continue to evolve, they'll help more with the gray area. And actually, you know, as I mentioned, you know, with respect to, you know, the Greg LeLond quote earlier around, you know, you only move faster, you know, never gets any easier, right? The role of the analyst will continue, right? They're just going to be empowered to make more, to manage more complex issues. In addition to the fact that as this technology evolves, illicit actors or bad actors will come up with more sophisticated ways of moving illicit funds into the financial system. And so, you know, these two tracks will need to keep up with one another.
I certainly think that in terms of moving illicit funds in the financial system, yeah, they're gonna go for those areas that are low tech. I mean, and then we come back to the topic of AI. I think, again, I've said this before on the show, you're not gonna lose your job to AI. You're probably gonna lose your job to a professional with a background similar to yourself who knows how to use AI to be more productive. Yes. So then it comes down to having the technical tools to make your people more productive.
Yeah, so exactly. So if I think I was a compliance officer today, you know, I think there's an acknowledgement that it is a multidisciplinary field now, right? It's not just pure regulatory, it's not just pure investigative, it's not just pure research, et cetera. You know, it's regulatory, it's legal, it's data science, it's geopolitics, right? It's technology. And there are a lot of great courses online. You know, again, you're in many ways almost a generalist, right, in a lot of these areas. So if you build, maybe you have a very strong background in regulatory, right? You can, through both on-the-job training, but also there are a lot of great online courses to, you know, even in a couple-week program, you know, if you're interested in machine learning, if you're interested in big data, right, and large language models, like you can go ahead and sign up for a course. And even that, just that additional, you know, even reading a book or several articles. And that's actually how I stayed up on all these different areas. My background is law, but it's just basically reading articles relevant to the industry and tangentially relevant over 20 years, you know, has given me enough of a general understanding, you know, to kind of fit the pieces together. And I think that is in many ways, you know, an important consideration for compliance officers as they continue to evolve in their role in their careers.
My critique of the profession is that we've got a lot of AML professionals, not too many money laundering professionals. And the degree, I mean, especially not to disparage people like ourselves who went to law school and, you know, that then started their careers, but it seems to me that too many people know the rules, they know the regs, they disparage the techies in this field, who are increasingly becoming more important, as you alluded to, with the importance of data science in this field. But it's the techies that I think have the more practical knowledge, because they're the ones that are, they're the ones that enable us to discern the the changing modalities of financial crime.
I think all the different ingredients are important to being able to, you know, effectively manage compliance issues. There are escalation paths, right, in FinCrime compliance, and there are issues that, you know, specifically require a legal expert to either manage, you know, opine on, build a policy around. Absolutely. I think that's going to remain, you know, for a while. But, you know, if you're looking at where the rubber meets the road, right, the intersection between regulatory data and tech, you know, I think that without having a view or understanding or an appreciation, right, of those different disciplines, it's going to be really hard to build a program that stands up to industry standards and regulatory muster these days.
Oh, for sure. It is a team effort. It's an interdisciplinary effort. I mean, one fellow I know at a local insurance giant, they're looking for someone on their regulatory reporting team, and they're thinking outside the box. And the critique is too many of the accountants and lawyers on his team don't know how to write, or at least not coherently. I mean, so much so that they are thinking so far out of the box, they're actually considering journalists and ad agency creative writers who know how to write. And the other thing I've noticed is, again, it is possible to become a compliance officer without having been a lawyer. Yes, there is a legal and a regulatory and rule-based component to it. People are able to pick it up. Not infrequently, you will see law enforcement, military, and former intelligence types going into compliance after, you know, and that's, it ends up becoming a plum retirement job for many of them. Why? Because they know how to do they know how to interview a certain way, which a lot of lawyers don't. And they know how to run investigations.
Exactly. You just have to be intellectually curious, right? Yeah. If I'm hiring somebody for my team, you know, their education is one thing, their training is another thing. But if somebody is intellectually curious, right?
Yeah.
2 + 2, you know, is not adding up to 4. And then they ask the question, why, right? That's really where you need to start. And so if you're going to have that as your foundation and you're going to become a Six Sigma, right, black belt in operations and project management, you could be extremely successful. You could be extremely successful without any formal education and training, right, and really just be extremely intellectually curious and have a passion for the industry. And so there are a lot of different backgrounds where you can be successful. Absolutely.
So coming back to ASAM and other similar such tools, Can you provide tangible examples on how such capabilities can be effectively utilized?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm not going to go into great detail, but, you know, certainly there is information when I was testing out ASAM that we identified in the negative news groupings that didn't fit into the traditional structured categories of news that we and my understanding a lot of you know, the industry provides. And it was just enough for me to say, okay, like kind of what we talked about, that's interesting. You know, I'd like to learn more, right? And so to be able to surface that in a way that, you know, if you're going back 5 years and you're pulling a bunch of articles based on a rules, you know, from a rules-based engine, and you're just, you know, your eyes are starting to glaze over because you're trying to look for headlines and information that's relevant. You know, that's inefficient. You're probably going to spend too much time in one area and you're going to miss potentially some of the more important things. So the regulatory expectations, the industry expectations weren't really such that you would then use unstructured data, right, at scale. Maybe for investigations, or definitely for investigations, but not for screening a million, 200 million people, et cetera. And so, you know, ASAM, again, with the news groupings, with the entity resolution, with machine learning can help you surface that information. And, you know, it doesn't make the decision green light, red light, you know, but what it does is it frames information that might not have been surfaced as quickly so that a financial crime compliance professional can decide if they're going to, investigate more, or sometimes can actually make a decision based on what's surfaced right away. So.
Okay. And lastly, for the next year or so, next 12 months, next year or two, what do you see as the pressing challenges that banking and financial institutions will likely face in terms of financial crime and technology-related risks, cybercrime, data privacy, whatnot, hacking?
Yeah. We talk about helping our clients identify and evaluate legal, regulatory, reputational issues, right? Cutting-edge technology, while, again, helping you potentially be more precise or cover more ground, also has legal, regulatory, reputational, and business impacts, right? And so being able to, there are a lot of providers out there, being able to identify the right providers who build a compliance-ready solution that can balance innovation with managing some of these other issues around GDPR, data privacy, compliant, making sure that they would stand up to compliance testing, et cetera, is very important. And it's a significant challenge for sure.
Oh, and one more thing regarding geopolitical risk. With the current situation with the Israelis and the Palestinians, do you see a greater emphasis on countering financial terrorism, the financing of terrorism moving forward? I mean, I think Binance shut down some accounts that were suspected of financing Hamas or related groups. What do you think about CFT? Because it's often lumped together with AML, KYC, FCC. Yeah. But, other than, whatever the Wolfsburg group think or the FATF in Paris think, it really post 9/11 CFT hasn't really gotten as much focus, as much discussion, unless you go to industry events like ACAMS or, the AFCS or even the Thompson Orange Pan-Asian Regulatory Summit. Is there going to be a greater emphasis on CFT given this current situation in Israel and in the broader Middle East?
Yeah, that's a great point and question. So a lot of our industry, right, was developed because the gravity and impact of terrorism and 9/11 exactly, and countless other, terrorist-related atrocities since then. So, but a lot of our industry was created because the gravity of those atrocities and that type of activity was so great. However, the overwhelming majority, right, of financial crime compliance or financial crime issues really are related to, corruption, tax cheating, other types of money laundering, other types of predicate offenses. I gave a talk a couple of weeks ago, and actually it was before, Hamas's heinous attack on Israel. And actually what I highlighted was, even though the percentage of suspicious activities reports in the U.S. is minuscule, like is extremely low that relate to terrorist finance, it's important that we don't fall asleep at the wheel. And I literally said that because of the potential impact. And actually just today, the Wall Street Journal, provided an article outlining the level of crypto-related currency that has been funneled to Hamas and other terrorist organizations, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, over the last 5 years, and it's in the tens of millions, right? And so
it doesn't take that much to finance a terrorist attack, as we saw.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. So, yeah, there's certainly a component, and you know, the again, you don't want to. While it's not, while it's an extremely difficult job to truly counter terrorist finance, especially because of what you just mentioned, you've got to make sure, as a financial institution, as a fintech, as a virtual asset service provider, that you're absolutely doing everything you can to prevent the facilitation of terrorist-related finance, because we've seen the videos, we've seen the pictures, and we see what the results are from this activity. And so, again, even though it's a small component in terms of overall volume of suspicious activity reports or STRs, et cetera, the gravity is such that you can't take your eye off the ball for a moment.
Yeah. 9/11 changed a lot of things. I lost friends that day. Many did. And that made me shift from, you know, wanting to go into IP or international law into financial regulation. And I wrote my dissertation on how the Patriot Act altered the earlier Bank Secrecy Act for correspondent banking purposes. And the interesting thing is, if you look at the legislative history, in the years leading up to 9/11, even earlier in 2001, you had Senator Carl Levin, formerly of Michigan. I'm not even sure if he's still alive. But you had him on the Senate floor imploring his colleagues on the need to tighten up the Bank Secrecy Act. And again, the need was there. It didn't seem as pressing. Can I say the U.S., many democracies, but the U.S. in particular tends to be very, very reactionary. If you wanted to respond to that.
No, I mean, I think the, so, you know, FATF, I think goes back to the late 80s, right? Yeah. I think it was on a lot of people's radars. You know, you of course had Bank of New York in the late 90s, right? And you understanding, you know, although it wasn't, you know, it was a different typology, you understand the destabilizing impact of money laundering. And I think, you know, 9/11 was certainly the catalyst that brought it to the forefront to, you know, for the U.S. Congress, which you're right, it is reactionary. And then we, you know, then certainly you saw the growth of a global regulatory framework because of the recognition of what, you know, what failing to prevent, you know, terrorist financing, in addition to all the other extremely important counterterrorism approaches focus areas, everybody needed to work together to prevent another 9/11.
In the time we've got left, is there anything you feel we didn't cover that we should have covered? Anything you'd like to say?
Well, I certainly want to thank you so much for your time and being able to participate in this discussion, AJ. And, you know, I do think kind of the key takeaway is, you know, as a financial crime compliance professional, it is really important to be open to different areas of expertise, right? To always ask that question, well, this doesn't add up. I'd like to learn more. And to, you know, if possible or practical, you know, develop some understanding of technology, project management, data science, regulatory, geopolitics, because again, you know, it's a multidisciplinary field and it continues to evolve in that direction and move in that direction.
In that vein, is there any advice you could give to our students who see themselves as, you know, budding compliance officers in AML, financial crime, or even, you know, KYC sanctions, regulatory reporting rules. Is there any advice you could give them? I mean, we do, and I want to put a quick plug for this. HKU has Asia's first Master of Laws degree in compliance and regulation, and we've run that program quite successfully for a number of years now. And obviously, having a good rooting in the having good grounding in the rules and the protocols and the processes and what will be expected of them as a compliance officer is important. But what more do they need to bring to the table? What more do they need to add? What would you say to them in terms of the continual learning aspect, which is increasingly going to be of a technological bent? What are your thoughts on that? What does the compliance officer of the 21st century have to have?
Yeah, I mean, I've always said it's important to make your background and experience unique. So if you are getting a master's of laws of law at a top university, then you're certainly ahead of the pack in many ways, developing that level of expertise and that expertise in Hong Kong, which is a major financial center in the Asia Pacific region. It also gives you the foundation to understand international law and international frameworks, which also impact your day-to-day as a compliance officer. And starting with that foundation, and then again, combining it with an understanding of technology, right, or big data, or just following things that are you're intellectually curious about. You never know how, one, it's something that you're interested in and enjoy, so that's important as well. But you also never know how it could potentially be helpful in your career, and especially in such a diverse and challenging role as a financial crime compliance officer.
Thank you so much for joining us, Michael. It's
thank you.
It's been illuminating. Please come back again. And
absolutely.
It'll be our pleasure. And to our viewers, thank you again for joining us. Until next time.